This war of five kings means nothing. The true war lies to the north, my king. Death marches on the wall. Only you can stop him.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to A Cast of Kings, an unofficial podcast about the HBO original series Game of Thrones. I'm David Chen, and with me is...
Joanna Robinson.
And we are going to continue right where we left off after the last episode of A Cast of Kings. And I think we were talking about the Davos storyline, we were talking about the White Walkers, we were talking about Melisandre. So let's get to the second part of this episode. Davos, and the thing I was going to say about the White Walkers is, from a storytelling perspective, Joanna Robinson, I am pretty leery of how they're using the White Walkers. Because here's what's happening, right? They are like building this thing up so much that what is it that could possibly result from this, right? Like, what is there going to be some huge, gigantic battle sequence that lasts for like 2 to 3 episodes long? Is it going to be like a huge war? Because I feel like anything less than that is going to be insufficient if you're spending 3 seasons building up this external threat. I mean, the House words are winter is coming. You know what I mean? And so this whole time it's like winter is coming, death is coming for everyone and everything, et cetera, et cetera. Like, there's this huge menace. You're just building up this huge menace. And the sort of part of my heart that's been broken so many times before by TV shows that build up to this huge thing and they never pay it off is just very wary of that. Do you feel like my concerns are justified, or do I sound like a crazy person?
Here's where I'll disagree with you, and it has nothing to do with like foreknowledge from the books. The comparison I'll draw, and the reason I'm thinking of it is because we had a listener write in and make a similar analogy to the Lord of the Rings. And if you think about Sauron and Mordor and that looming threat of what's going to happen to everyone if, you know, Sauron comes to power and that sort of stuff, did that conclude in a giant, thrilling battle, or was the more interesting story Frodo and Samwise and Gollum and throwing the ring into a fire? Like, that's how that story ended. But you had, for 3 books and 3 movies, this looming threat of death and destruction and everyone glooming and dooming about what's going to happen when these people take power. So I disagree with you that we necessarily have to see something tremendous. I feel like the White Walkers can be the boogeyman without having to have the biggest battle you've ever seen in your entire life.
Okay. I think that's a legit pushback on me. It's kind of a compound concern, right? Because on the one hand, there is this menacing threat, but then on the other hand, we also have storylines that continue to splinter and get like geometrically more complex. And there is a concern that each one of these storylines is going to get a satisfactory payoff, right? And actually, I think that concern came to the forefront last week. I'll try to find the email, but someone essentially wrote in saying, was it worth it to have Rob kind of march around aimlessly for a while, win a few battles, and then die ignominiously?
The same thing happened with Renly, where like Renly was sort of built up as this contender to the throne, and then that was cut short. You know, and I think his storyline is interesting, and mostly it's interesting for the way in which it echoes and ripples through the universe, you know, and in the way in which it is damaged Stannis to have killed his brother. So, you know, with Rob's storyline, we're going to continue to see the ripples of how it affects his sisters and his brothers, right? And the whole political scheme of the universe that we're involved in. So it's not just Rob himself. It's how these actions continue to affect the characters who are still going. You know,
It's a good point. You're making good points. I guess I'm trying to poke holes in your analogy, really, is what I'm trying to do.
I know. Is it working?
You know, hole number one is that you have all these different characters and how are they possibly going to get paid off? And hole number two is that there's a difference between like 3 movies worth of building a menacing threat and, you know, like between like 10 hours versus 50 to 60 hours. Do you know what I'm saying?
I don't think the Lord of the Ring epic I mean, yeah, there are three movies, but those books take a while to read. Like, you know, I don't yeah. think that you can really make that time analogy work perfectly.
I mean, fair point. I mean, I think like what we're seeing is that what we've clearly already seen is that this is not a conventional show, right? That this is not a conventional hero's journey, and that people who expect those things will be sorely disappointed.
Right, but like, how many boring, typical hero's journeys have we seen, and do we?
No. I'm complimenting the show now. What I'm saying is that it's decided to take a different perspective. It's decided to kind of be an omniscient force in a world that is brutal and harsh and unforgiving, right? And that so you see characters rise to power and then die an episode later. You just have no idea what's going to happen to them, right? And so, in a sense, like we can't really use our conventional narrative expectations and apply them to this show. And so, like point taken that like a show like Game of Thrones may be able to pull off a menacing threat of White Walkers over the course of 6 or 7 seasons, and you only catch glances of them and only see a few horse head formations, right? And but then it, ultimately, like, what is worth it is the journey that the characters go through
right.
as they try to defend against them.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's totally plausible accounting of events, for sure.
And the same could be true of, you know, if you want to talk about a more recent, more accessible work of sci-fi fantasy, you can talk about the Harry Potter series. And the similar thing is true where Voldemort is this looming threat.
Right. A series of films which I pretty much absolutely hated, by the way. So like,
right. But it's hugely popular in pop culture, which you can't deny. And the point of
I can't deny it to myself in my own room
okay.
in a fetal position.
Okay.
Repeatedly.
But the point of that journey, you know, is it becomes a smaller journey of a hero's sacrifice rather than a giant battle with, I mean, there is a giant battle. But anyway, the point, the satisfaction that people glean from Harry Potter does not come from the giant battle at Hogwarts. It comes from the small sacrifice of one person. Do you know?
Right.
Which is telling the same story of Lord of the Rings. That's my main criticism of Harry Potter is it's retelling a story we've already seen. But I think the same is true. I mean, and I'm not talking about foreknowledge of the books because George R. R. Martin's not done. So I don't know how the journey ends. So I'm not talking, you know, I'm not saying there's an equivalent of someone throwing a ring in a fiery pit because that's, I don't know how the story ends.
Right.
But what I'm saying is that I think, and I've already said that I think book 4 gets a little bogged down, as does book 5 to a certain extent. And so, which I think they're going to do a good job snipping in the TV show. But thus far, what we've seen is so compelling and satisfactory, and we care so deeply about some key characters that, you know, I really want to find out what happens to, and then I won't say who, because then you'll be like, oh, then I know they don't die, blah, blah, blah. But like, you know,
these
X, Y, and Z characters that I've come to love, I really care about what happens to them.
Right.
So, you know.
Okay. No, you've temporarily swayed me from being concerned about the White Walkers as a sinking force.
Awesome.
So, I mean, we were talking about Davos, right? And how he got saved at the last second because he said, "You need me, Stannis," right? Stannis is about to execute him. Because Stannis sentenced him to death, right?
Right.
And he was about to execute him, but Melisandre, ironically, ended up saving him. And can you talk a little bit here about the show notes about Lannister parallels and how did he die here? I'm not really sure what you're getting at because before this scene, right, Gendry and Davos have this conversation. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, the parallels between what Tywin said about his son. I talked about this in part one, but just sort of the theme of fathers and sons,
right?
And the Lannister parallel where Davos is talking about his son. And what Tywin said is that the mark of a good man is someone who will do anything to make sure his children have the best, a better life, that he's constantly bringing up his family. That's what Tywin says is the mark of a good man. And Davos tells Gendry, "I didn't even want to be a knight. And then Gendry's like, well, why did you do it? And he said, I did it for my sons, so that my sons could be the sons of knights and have a better life and not have to live on, you know, Tin Pan Alley or whatever the name of where he grew up was.
I think it was Tin Pan Alley, actually.
No, it wasn't. But, you know, and then Gendry's like, what happened to your son? And Davos is like, he died, and because he followed me. And so it's sort of about, is that the, like, I feel like Davos regrets ever becoming a knight because he feels like he led his son to his death, and it's brought him nothing but grief, and he would really prefer he had stayed a smuggler and done that instead. And so I feel like he's learned the opposite lesson of whatever it is that Tywin feels like he's clinging to. And what has happened to the Lannisters because of Tywin's greed, you know, and constant power brokering? His daughter is completely bitter and unhappy. His son has lost his hand, you know, like, they're not doing super peachy. Even though Joffrey is king, like, they're not doing super peachy. And so, like, the thesis seems to be, maybe that's not the mark of a good man. Maybe the mark of a good man is more like Ned Stark, but no, his kids aren't doing very well either. But, like, you know,
I think the mark of a good man is Varys. He doesn't have any kids. But I mean, seriously, Varys is kind of like, do whatever is necessary for the good of the realm, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, he started out life disadvantaged in the sense that he got his genitals cut out of him. But
right, and he had to hook his way to the top.
Right. Thanks for using the hook language. But yeah, you know, this ties in with the whole theme of, like, that if you think about the decision for Ned to go to King's Landing and become the Hand of the King, he did it with noble intentions. But think of the untold misery and suffering that's been inflicted on his family as a result of that singular decision.
Right.
That people who attempt to do noble things generally meet horrific ends. Or that it ends up getting twisted somehow. But I think, as you pointed out in the past, it doesn't really matter. You could be evil or good. You're probably going to end up getting screwed over.
Right. I mean, yeah, that's the, like, ineffable sort of nature of the Game of Thrones universe. It's not a clear-cut moral reward or punishment. It's like, life is short and brutish and nasty, and, like, you do what you can. But, like, maybe at the end we can look back and try to, like, glean what George R. R. Martin's thesis is by determining who ends up on the throne or who ends up surviving. But I don't think we're at a point right now where we can say that.
Ultimately, his point may be that, you know, there is no order to be found. Right. I think that's entirely possible. I will say it does feel to me as though we see a lot more quote-unquote good guys die on this show than quote-unquote bad guys. That could just be because we feel the impact of their loss more deeply. So I don't know that, you know, maybe at the end you could just pile up the bodies on, like, the good guy and the bad guy scale and see which one.
Yeah, one of you listeners should make an infographic of, like, the good guys and the bad guys. But isn't it more interesting to tell the story of, like, well, this ties in exactly what I want to talk about in terms of Stannis in this episode and in the show in general. I feel like, and many people have pointed out how they did this very obvious framing of Stannis with Melisandre on one shoulder and Davos on the other in the background, that sort of angel and demon dynamic. Like, it was like an anvil over the head shot that the showrunners did. And I don't like that as much. I feel like they're painting Stannis as morality neutral, and then he's just pulled in these two different directions by these two forces. And I just feel like that's an oversimplification of the character in the book. You've criticized in the past the Stannis character in the show, and I think it's true. I don't think they're quite doing him justice.
Because he sounds like a much more morally complex character.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, whereas here I feel like any way the wind blows, that's where Stannis decides to go in the movie, in the TV show universe, you know.
Not to mention he's like 90% an asshole in the show. Which it sounds like he's not as much in the books.
No, I mean, I don't know. I don't know what to say. He's grim. It's hard to love him.
Fair enough.
But people do, so I don't know.
So yeah, so those are some thoughts on how the show is going to end and what the ultimate thesis of the show is. But I think the whole idea of the world being life being nasty, brutish, and short, right, is, you know, really George R. R. Martin is the reincarnation of Hobbes, I think.
Right. I mean, clearly.
He took Hobbes' philosophy. Go ahead.
You're talking about the tiger, right?
No.
I'm just kidding.
He took Hobbes' philosophy and applied it to a medieval-esque world. But, one of the concerns for me is that we have these plot lines, right? We have Stannis and Melisandre. We have the Daenerys storyline. We have the Joffrey and Tyrion storyline. We have Bran now. And we have Arya and Sansa. And so, like, I just... And Jon Snow and the Night's Watch. And so it is very challenging for a show to tie up those plot lines in a satisfying way. Right? Now, granted, that number of plot lines he's had to tie up has been eliminated significantly since last episode. Right? And yes. And there will continue to be pruning, I'm sure, both by the showrunners and by Martin. But very few shows have been able to do that successfully. I would say probably The Wire is one of them, right?
Yeah.
Where there's dozens of characters, and at the end, you know, the fifth season wasn't the strongest, but at the end of The Wire, I felt, okay, I kind of am pretty satisfied with where each of these characters went, right? Like what their ending was. There were very few characters that I was like, man, whatever happened to that guy, right? But The Wire is like a singularity. You know what I mean? It's like very, very few shows are of that caliber. I think Game of Thrones has a shot at being like that, certainly.
Yeah. And I would say Lost is an example of not doing that very well.
Well, that's just like your opinion, man.
I like Lost. That is just like my opinion, man. Dude, listen, I like Lost. I do. But I was very happy when they started, as you euphemistically put it, tying up plot lines by axing people left and right. Because there were very few characters that I cared so deeply about on Lost. And then you would get bogged down in these other plot lines that's how I felt. And I think you're right that I think Game of Thrones is doing a more Wire-esque job of making each plot line compelling. I was just thinking about the Sansa plot line today and how in the beginning, I was not convinced that Sophie Turner was sort of up for her proven completely wrong.
Can you repeat that again, Joanna?
Oh, yeah. That in the beginning, in the first season, I was not convinced that Sophie Turner, who plays Sansa, was up for what the story had in store for her. You know, like this season, marrying Tyrion and finding out about her. You know, but like she broke my heart in this episode without saying a word. And that is because her performance has been so good for so long, and I care so deeply about that character. And I just think that for the most part, the characters and the performances have been so good in this show that we're invested in so many different places. There are weaknesses in that. I've always said, like with Jon Snow or Shay, but you know, like they've done a good job. I'm just agreeing with you, basically, in a long-winded way. So I'll stop now.
It's all good. It was funny. There's this at happyplace.com. They do these Game of Thrones summaries, right? If Game of Thrones took place entirely on Facebook,
yeah, right? They did a really good one for Downton Abbey too.
Yeah, they are quite hilarious, very creative, and very nerdy because they require a pretty good knowledge of Facebook to truly get. And I love this description when Sansa Stark posts a link to Urban Dictionary, sheep shift, to cut a hole in someone's sheets and stuff sheep shift in there so it smells. And then Sansa comments on it, sheep shift, you know, like when sheep shift out their poop. And Tyrion comments, you literally don't know the word shit. How have you stayed alive this long in this city? And that is a good question. She literally doesn't know the word shit.
Yeah, exactly.
That possibility wasn't like even in my head. You know what I mean? Because I think, and to be like, again, I love the scene. I will say like the fact that Sansa, I'm guessing, is played by an actress that's a little bit older than she is in the books, took away a little bit from the believability of that scene for me. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So.
But she's been so sheltered. And think about how tiny she was when the show started. Like. Right. She just lives in her little Sansa bubble. Well, except it's being pierced left and right by, like, all of her family being killed in front of her.
Yeah. Yeah, that is rough.
Next time one of her family members gets killed, if they do, I want her to say the word shit. Oh, shit.
I do wonder what Melisandre's game here with is with his Davos situation. Like, is are they just going to use Davos and then discard him? Because I mean, he's clearly shown himself to be a loose cannon. Do you know what I mean? Like, he's clearly not a guy that could necessarily be trusted. He marches to the beat of his own drum. Do you know what
right.
I'm saying?
Sure.
So it was weird to me that Melisandre saved him. Because she said, no, we do need this guy. And my first thought was, wait, why? Like, why can't you just use your Lord of Light powers? You know, haven't you demonstrated that your god has the ability to revive people from the freaking dead and save you from poison and use smoke babies to kill people? Why do you need this Davos guy to round up some people? That was a little weird to me. But any comment on that, Joanna?
I'm afraid to comment on this
okay.
plotline.
Okay, fair enough. It's cool. So anyway,
they revealed. I am afraid to talk about this.
Okay.
So we'll move on.
Let's move on. So anyway, then we finally get a scene with Baylon, and we mentioned this scene earlier in the podcast, but I don't think we really talked about this, right? Baylon gets a raven from the Dreadfort, and we. This is after we have the reveal of that Theon has been castrated, right?
Right. The delightful sausage scene.
Right.
Theon disobeyed my orders. The boy's a fool. He cannot further the Greyjoy line. I will not give up the lands I have seized, the strongholds I have taken. Get this away from me.
He's your son.
Son? He's not a man anymore.
He's your son. He's my brother. He's a Greyjoy.
Watch yourself. I've made my decision.
Let me just say this. Anytime there is a box that's covered with a cloth, and you slowly sort of pull the cloth off the box, I just find that terrifying as a, like, movie convention. Do you know what
uh-huh.
I mean? Like, it just – whenever you see – there was actually a really great scene in Kevin Smith's Red State where this happened. I don't know if you
– I didn't see that one, no.
Okay. So if you actually – if you look at the trailer for Red State, there's – you kind of see a quick shot of, like, a cloth being pulled slowly off a box. And it always – just the movement of the fabric and this idea that you're revealing something horrific always just really bothers me. And certainly that was the case here as well, where, you know, Theon's father was not particularly forgiving, right, in this scene. And Yara was much more forgiving. And so one question I have for you is, do you think in the show enough character work has been done with the Yara character to sort of justify the decisions that she makes in this episode?
No, not at all. And no, I think they've done a really poor job with the Ironborn. They didn't show them at all this season, right? This is
right.
the first we're seeing Baylon and Yara this season. And like, don't you feel like they could have cut one of Theon's torture scenes to like check in with the Ironborn? Like,
I mean, I think
at some
they could
point?
Have cut like three of.
But
I mean,
what was
oh, okay? Oh, and let me mention this point, Joanna Robinson. Okay, let me just make sure I make this clear. Let me return to that point about. Can Game of Thrones be like a masterpiece show that's as good as a show like The Wire, right? That's ultimately what we want it to be, right?
Right.
And so people are asking, well, why do you guys get to bring up the nudity stuff all the time? And it's like, because the nudity, the gratuitous nudity undercuts that mission, in my opinion, right? That a show that is as good as a show like The Wire or, you know, whatever other show, take a pick from like the greatest shows in the history of television. The Wire... I think one is The Shield. Some people think Lost. You know, whatever you want to choose. Do you have any that are in your, you know...
I put Justified and Breaking Bad.
Justified and Breaking Bad are on there. You know, some people might put Mad Men on there. The Sopranos, right? Take your pick. But, like, those shows did not traffic in I would say very few of those shows, or if any, use nudity in as gratuitous a fashion as we see on Game of Thrones.
Well, right? That's because, everything you just listed, except for The Wire.
And The Sopranos.
But, Deadwood used nudity.
Right, and we did not list that show.
No, but I would put Deadwood on there.
Yeah, sure. Okay, no, you're right. But do you know what I mean? I do think, when you make stupid decisions that are clearly meant to titillate and not necessarily for the benefit of the story, you undercut your mission at being one of the greatest shows of all time. And the reason I bring it up is because you were just talking about Theon's torture scene. I mean, did we really need that totally unnecessary scene with those people that strip down naked and try to hump him? Do you know what I mean? Could we not have gotten some more Balon and Yara backstory?
Or some more sausage jokes. I can't get enough of those sausage jokes.
I know you can't get enough of that stuff. So you think it's really poor. I think it's okay. I actually don't. I'm actually a little bit more forgiving than you are. Because I just thought the Theon stuff was so compelling in season two that they had built up enough. Do you know what I mean? To make this scene kind of pay off. And there was that one scene that Yara and Theon had when Yara left Winterfell, right?
Right.
And that's really all you get. I could have used a little bit more. You know what I mean? It wasn't one of my favorite executions of a storyline here where Yara is just like, I'm going to take these guys. We're going to go get my brother back.
And it was this super cheesy voiceover as she's stalking onto her ship and the music swells. And it did not work for me. Mm-hmm. The thing I want to go back really quickly and talk about Ramsay's gift of Theon's favorite toy in a box for them. And that was, I believe, if I'm correct, that the box had a kraken carved on the top, which is the Greyjoy sigil. So he sent Theon's penis in a decorative box to his family. Ramsay Snow is such a sick puppy. I can't even tell you. And I think the actor is doing an amazing job at portraying one sick puppy. The other thing I want to talk about in the Balon and Yara scene is that once again, we get this son parallel where Balon's he can't produce any heirs. He's useless to me. He can't produce any heirs. I don't care about my son. I abandon him. This was them once again hitting home that theme of fathers and sons and stuff like that. And as I talked about in the last podcast we recorded, this is the episode where we're really feeling that absence of the son of the series, which is Robb Stark. And so to watch these other fathers and son talk about their sons or relate to their sons was kind of interesting. But for me, it didn't really pay off with the Balon and Yara stuff. And once again, I just really did not like that whole swelling of music and her big dramatic storming onto the ship, I'm going to go get my brother bullshit. I didn't
Now that I reconsider it, I do think there probably wasn't quite enough there to justify that decision.
Right.
That Yara feels something for Theon. She feels pity for him. But there's not quite enough for you to really be would she really do this? Because the thing is, Yara spent so much time being a jerk to him in the last season.
Right.
And there was kind of this moment of compassion that she has for him towards the end of season two. And that's really all you have to go on, right?
Right.
Even their initial meeting with her father, she is not I have compassion for Theon. So the more I think about it and the more you talk through it, the less sympathetic I am to this story.
Right. When you compare it to when I won't say that, but let's just compare it to Tyrion and Cersei worrying about Jaime all season. It makes more sense. That makes more sense because, Tyrion, Jaime's the only one who's nice to Tyrion and Cersei wants to bone him. So, their motivation makes more sense. Or when you had Jon Snow wanting desperately to get off the wall when he finds out that Ned Stark is dead, those connections are there. And as you say, that's not the dynamic they established between Yara and Theon in the show.
Right.
So it doesn't make much sense.
The thing is, again, it was so good what was established. I was willing to give this a lot of leeway, but there just wasn't quite enough there. It was just under what I would have liked. If they just get just a little bit more, just a taste.
Or a little bit less. If the music had been a little calmer and she had been yeah, you know what? Fuck you, Dad. I'm going to go get my brother. I'd have been all right, you go, Yara. But it just struck the wrong note for me. So
The Balon performance there is pretty interesting because he's you know saying like he's not my son, he can't produce any heirs, and I am kind of I do kind of read a lot into that performance and what he's trying to say, right?
Yeah.
Like what is the anger? Like there appears to be some anger, right? And I feel like my interpretation is it's a mix of damn my son for putting me into this position and. This whole disfiguring, you know, thing gives me a reason to kind of disown him. But I'm still deeply internally conflicted about disowning him anyway. I don't know.
Like, I think you're layering on some stuff there, and that's fine because we all do that.
Or is it just outright hatred? Is it just like I hated my son to begin with, and now I hate him even more? I don't think so. It wasn't that simple to me. It wasn't okay. Just like I hate him, and now he's even worse because he's hindering my goals. Right? I didn't feel that way. I thought there was a lot of ambivalence and internal conflict with what Balon was going through.
But didn't he threw the box on the fire? Right?
No. I think he threw the letter in the fire.
Oh, just the letter. Okay.
Yeah. I don't think he threw the box in the fire.
Okay.
So Yara is going to go get Theon, and presumably we find out what happens to Theon next season. Again, just to cap off this plotline, kind of baffling what they chose to do with it, right? Like,
well, someone brought up the good point that, which they haven't really directly addressed in the show, is the fact that Ramsay's the one responsible for raising Winterfell, like.
Oh yeah, we neglected to mention that,
right?
In the last week's episode,
and that makes more sense than the argument I was trying to make earlier, which is Rob would be upset if he found out Ramsay was like torturing Theon in the way that he was because of amnesty laws or whatever. But like, no, he burnt the Stark home to the ground and killed all of its inhabitants. So that would be the tip off. That maybe Roose Bolton does not have the Stark interests in heart. You know what I mean?
Right. But is that clear until this episode, though? That
no.
That Ramsay was responsible for that?
No.
Right. So it's revealed that Ramsay, single-handed, apparently.
No, he had men.
No,
had
I know.
Yeah.
Men who were apparently like incredibly disposable to him. Into the extent that he killed them just to play games with
for Theon. For funsies.
You know what I mean?
And target practice. Yeah.
I mean, they weren't nice men. Weren't they going to rape Theon at some point? Right.
I mean, who wouldn't?
So, jeez. Okay. That was a little bit over the line, Joe.
I know.
But,
I take it back.
So Ramsay essentially is sent by, just so we have the plot line clear, sent by Roose Bolton to kind of make this offer, like, turn over Theon and the rest of you Ironborn can live. They turn over Theon, and Ramsay not only kills the other Ironborn men, but burns down Winterfell and then proceeds to torture Theon relentlessly and then castrate him. Is that
I believe
correct?
That is the show plotline, yes.
Okay. If you guys know differently, email us at acastofkings@gmail.com.
I've said before, it's slightly different in the book, so.
Right.
But I believe that's what the thesis of the show was.
In which case, yes, he's very messed up and should not be allowed to exist.
But didn't you love, I mean, like I've said before, I didn't really care about that, like, the bit with the sausage. But, like, don't you love that guy's performance?
Yeah, no, it's great. It's great.
He's so great. Anyway, we can move on.
He's fantastic. He's really evil. Do you know what I mean? Like, but.
Yeah.
But
like, you thought Joffrey was a sick little monkey? Like, meet Ramsay Snow.
Yeah.
He is a fucker. He gets a decorative box to send a penis in. So
why, you know? Why does a decorative box bother you so much? Like, would it have been better if it was like a plastic bag?
It's like that extra like creepy Hannibal touch where it's like, I'm not just going to do something like really violent and disgusting and repugnant. I'm going to make a bit of art about it. You know
right.
what I mean?
Right.
It's like in spoilers for Buffy the Vampire Slayer, when in season 2, when a certain character is killed, like this whole stage is set. And that's just what drives the act of violence from like just a pure act of violence to just really sick mania of like, I've taken the time to make this something beautiful out of something like disgusting. You know?
Did you think that they were going to show what was inside the box?
No. But I also But I mean, especially since we haven't gotten any like penises attached to men in the show, like hardly any. Please don't send me more.
Yeah. Why would you? Why would you tempt fate again by pointing that out?
Please don't send me.
There have been tons of you know, male frontal nudity, or not tons, but there has been
two instances.
I think we saw some of Jamie's balls this season as well.
Right? Oh, okay. Oh, joy. Yeah. No, I don't think they would. I didn't think they would show us that. But like I said before, I didn't think they would show us the direwolf sewed onto Robb Stark's body. Like, I didn't think they would go there, and they did. So, you know, who knows?
Yeah. So we'll see what happens with the Theon storyline. But what I was just going to say was that, you know, could they have, however that pays off, whether she rescues him or not, it certainly feels to me like she is going to rescue him, but you never know with the show. Couldn't they have just done that all in this season, right? Like, couldn't they have had that rescue scene this season and just compressed the on storyline so it wasn't as long and as brutal?
Or, you know, conversely, have that whole thing with the Ironborn start next season. Like, you know, a lot of people are saying, oh, the showrunners had a really hard task in the finale because we had to check in with everyone. So, of course, it seemed like scattered. But did we? Did we have to check in with the Ironborn, or could they have just popped up in the premiere next year?
Right.
You know? And, like, there are just a few things that I don't feel like we needed to check in with every single person in order for me to feel like I had a grasp of the universe.
I agree.
Yeah. You know?
I agree.
So.
All right, so only a couple more plot lines to mention. Let's just let's talk about Arya, right? And you know, I complained last week that Arya always seems like she's about to do something and then never does it. Well, this week, as if they were listening to my complaints,
Oh, I'm sure they do.
I'm sure they do, and they changed the show retroactively. To accommodate them. She kills a dude this episode, like with malice aforethought this time, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this scene was pretty chilling for a variety of reasons, because not only does Arya kill the dude, but she kind of pretends – she uses her not feminine – whatever the childlike equivalent of feminine wiles is. Do you know what I mean? She tries to be like a cute kid and lull them into a false sense of security before stabbing
the
guy.
She's like, but I'm hungry.
Yeah.
And they're like, ugh.
What was funny to me was that that did not work at all. Like in a normal scene in a movie, they'd be like, oh, okay, come here, little girl. We'll help you out. And then she would use that to get in and stab them in their throats. But instead, they're just like, get out of here. So it was almost like that was totally unnecessary. She didn't have to do any of that. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
But it was still chilling to know that she could. Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And she and the Hound have this kind of funny moment where the Hound's like, please tell me if you're going to do that again. I thought I was watching like Lethal Weapon 1. Do you know what
Black,
I mean?
What? They're not going to do.
Come on, guy. Like, don't get me in that mess again. And she picks up the coin that Jaqen gives her and says, follow Morghulis, right? Mm-hmm. So remind us, John Robinson, what was it that he said at the end of last season with regards to the coin and follow Morghulis?
Okay. I'm not 100% sure what he said in the show, but I know from the book, I'm pretty sure it's the same as what happens in the book, where he gives her the iron coin and he says this, give this to any man of Braavos, which is where he's from, and say Valar Morghulis if you need to, like, if you need to find me. I think it's if you need to find me. So, you know, she used it in this little gambit, but not, it's not the same thing. You know, she didn't give it to a man of Braavos, so it's not the same thing. But
she was kind of invoking it anyway.
Yeah, she was like invoking the memory of Jaqen H'ghar by.
I see. So she wasn't actually calling him.
No, no.
And we know this because Roose Bolton is not from Roose Bolton's men are not from Braavos.
Right. They're from Westeros.
I thought it was interesting that they were kind of talking about how difficult it was to sew the head onto Robb's. It was kind of a very amusing scene, almost. About,
like a Martha Stewart how to sew a direwolf onto a decapitated body. Yeah. You got to really anchor it underneath the collarbone, you know, to get it to stick.
Yeah. So pretty amusing. Although I don't remember who it was. Was it Pat that brought this up about how did those people get farther than Arya and the Hound?
Yeah.
Like if they were there that night? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
Geography. The geography in the show is so messed up, you know? I couldn't stop thinking about it. Not really. It was totally fun. So, totally chilling scene. And the way, like, Arya has no, I mean, she's just straight up sociopath at this point, right? Like, there is no emotional reaction to the dude, these dudes just bleeding out in front of her and knowing that she had caused it, right?
Well, I mean, and this is what, you know, you expressed your frustration a couple times about Arya, you know, not just last week, but a couple times about Arya not pulling the trigger, as it were, on killing someone. And I don't know if I mentioned this last year, I'm pretty sure I did, that she does kill, when they escape Harrenhal, she does kill someone. So they saved that for this season. And I think they built up to it quite nicely with several scenes over the season, like that scene around the fire where she was talking to Thoros and Beric. You know, and it, like, I feel like we've seen her darkness build this season in a way that they didn't necessarily have time to build last season. They focused more on the Tywin Arya back and forth, and it wasn't so much about her getting darker and darker. It was about, you know, other things, whatever that was. But
whatever that whole interaction was.
Whatever that was about. But this season, they did that. Because in the books, she's basically tortured at Harrenhal. Not, like, physically tortured, but, like, she's in servitude there for a really long time. And you know, her psyche is in a different place than they had time to really show on the TV show. And so I think it's good that they delayed and pushed it here, because I think the darkness really made a lot of sense here. And the look on Maisie Williams' face when she saw the direwolf head on Rob's body, you know, she's, like, resting against the hound, and just her face got so, like, bleak and stony. And it made a lot of sense to me. And I also like that line when the hound was like, "Is this the first man you've killed?" And she goes, "Yeah, first man," because she killed that boy in season one.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I like this choice. You know, people accuse me of being too much of a stickler about the book, but I like this choice to move the kill to this season, because I just think they needed that extra time to build her, to make her believably dark from the little girl we met in season one.
Yeah, you know? And I think it was well executed. I mean, I think that it took maybe a little bit too long for my taste, but now that it's happened, it's like, okay, she's clearly set on this path of darkness, and it is not good.
Right.
And people will die at her hand. And that's kind of exciting to me from a viewer of the show standpoint, not from some sick Joffrey-like standpoint. You know what I mean? Just that, like, this character is finally going in an interesting direction, even if it is horrifyingly bad. So there was the reunion of Jaime and Cersei this episode.
Right.
And very few words. We did see that Jaime was kind of treated as a commoner, and that was kind of amusing, seeing him taken. It's always great to see Jaime taken down a peg when it's not him drinking horse piss, you know?
Yeah, what do you call him, like, country boy or something like that? Get out of the way. But what was interesting to me is that basically there was a silent exchange of looks between Jaime and Brienne, and then they sort of walk into the courtyard and King's Landing and stuff like that. And then there was that silent exchange between Cersei and Jaime. And I felt so much more between Brienne and Jaime than I felt between Cersei and Jaime, you know?
Yeah, no. Well, actually, I would say it's comparable. I mean, because Cersei has been kind of so worried about Jaime this entire time, and you've seen it throughout the course of many episodes. So I did feel like there was this catharsis when they finally saw each other again.
Right.
And there was kind of this question of, like, what is happening? What
and then
now?
She, like, looked at his stump, and then he looked at his stump, and then he was like, what are you going to do? I got a stump now. I don't know. That scene didn't do it. It didn't drive home for me. But I really did like whatever it was that passed between Brienne and Jaime. I thought that was
the look on Cersei's face. I just thought was pretty great. So one thing that a lot of listeners wrote in to point out that I thought was kind of interesting was a lot of question about how much Jaime Lannister knew about the Red Wedding plot before the Red Wedding actually occurred. Right. Mm-hmm. I don't think that the show has actually revealed that information.
Mm-hmm.
So please, that's my way of saying, please don't give that away, Joanna.
I already had my, like, I was already biting my lip. It wasn't going to happen.
Okay, good. But, you know, there was, like, if you go back to those episodes, that some of Jamie's words are chilling in retrospect, right? Like, tell Robb Stark the Lannisters send the regards, right? I mean,
or promising, I think what our listener pointed out was if he did know about the Red Wedding, promising Brienne that he would reunite the girls with their mother.
Yeah, they will be with their mother.
Is oh yeah, that's even worse, right? So if he did know about the Red Wedding.
And I mean, I think that's kind of, again, I'm not against cliffhangers, okay? Like, let me just make that clear. I'm cool with cliffhangers. But I am mildly bummed that we didn't get to see Brienne find out about the Red Wedding, right? Because presumably she's going to find out at some point, and she's going to know that Jaime was probably responsible, and that is going to throw a monkey wrench into their relationship, I got to think.
Just a tiny one.
So,
like one of those wee little traveling.
Do you know what I mean? So I just kind of wish, like now we're not going to find out for another year what Brienne's reaction to something that we already know happened.
Not to mention her strong affection for Catelyn, her allegiance to Catelyn.
Right, that's my point. Point is that she is clearly like serving Catelyn, and man, she is not going to be happy when she finds out that Jaime was partially responsible for Catelyn's brutal death. It's not that like, oh, this thing is going to happen next season that we don't get to see this season. It's that, that this thing that already happened this season, we're not going to get to see another character react to it until next season.
Someone was saying, I think it was, Dustin Rolls, who writes for Pajiba, who runs Pajiba, where I work, said that he wanted this episode to just be a montage of people's reaction faces to finding out about the Red Wedding.
Right.
Because we also didn't, Bran and Rickon didn't find out. John didn't find out. You know, there's like a whole bunch of people who still need to know about Rob and Kat.
Right. So. Right. Yeah, I guess that totally escaped my mind that Bran would need to find out.
Not to mention all of Talisa's family in Volantis. Like, let's go to Volantis and find out about,
if that is where she's really from.
Dun, dun, dun. Volantis, I should say. Sorry.
So then we get to the most probably controversial scene of the episode, which is Daenerys waiting outside the walls of Yunkai and greeting the liberated slaves, right? That they had laid down their arms and they surrendered. And so now she's going to greet the liberated slaves.
I love someone, I forget where, someone was like, oh yeah, Jorah's the type of good guy who says liberate instead of conquer. You didn't conquer them, you liberated them.
Right, right. And, this is the thing that you're going to end this season with. And so the slaves come out, and we got to say, like, from a visual standpoint, it was glorious, right? Like, it looked fantastic. You have all these Unsullied lining up, then you have all these slaves, like, slowly filling out this space. And it looked awesome. It looked amazing.
Well, that part looked fine. I don't know, but the final...
Yeah, so, CGI. Joanna, I got to say, I was profoundly bothered by this scene for a variety of reasons. First of all, let's put aside the mildly sinister racial undertones. This is just an incredibly cheesy scene, right? That, oh, they're all saying, what are they calling her? Mother, right?
Yeah.
That's what Misa is translation for mother.
Yeah.
And the idea that these slaves would just be calling out mother and, like, crowd surfing Daenerys, it just is just really cheesy, man. Like, I don't know. I just did not I don't think that I had the emotions that the showrunners wanted me to have at this moment.
Right? No, I don't think so.
I think they wanted me to be like, oh my gosh, I'm in awe. Like the opening scene of Lion King, right? Which actually genuinely does create awe in me, right?
Or like, even to take a Daenerys scene, the scene where she walks out of the fire, or stands up with her dragons.
Yeah.
And all of her and her Khalasar bows down to her. You know, like Daenerys has had, or the scene at the end of last season where, her dragons go off in the House of the Undying, or this year with Astapor. Like, we've seen it over and over again, these cool things with Daenerys, and they just like whiffed it.
Yeah,
this
they missed the boat, because that is just so cheesy to have all these people calling out mother. I mean, let's just say in English, if this scene was in English, it would be unforgivably bad, right? Like, if you imagine all those people calling out mother, like, you would laugh in this scene's metaphorical face.
But I'll say that I did not laugh when I read it. That okay. I thought it was done well in the books, and I talked to you about this a little bit, because I didn't even get, and it's because it wasn't a visual for me. I didn't even get skeeved out by any sort of racial white liberator nonsense. Not, and I did with the show, but I didn't when I read the chapter.
Right. I can imagine why reading it, you're like, the way they describe it can be very awe-inspiring, right? That these people are lifting her above and so on. But in the context of a visual medium, it just does not look as awe-inspiring.
No, and they don't lift and crowd surf her. She's on her horse. She's on a horse going through a crowd of people, she sort of like gallops through. There is no crowd surfing in the book.
But are they all calling out Mother?
Yeah, they all are calling out Mother. But why it resonates with her, you know, which you could extrapolate, is this theme that they haven't done a very good job of hammering home in the book, which is in the show, which is that she won't ever have children of her own.
Right.
She talks about the dragons as being her children. So it's poignant for her that they call her Mother because she will never actually be a mother. And that is a very upsetting, traumatic thing that happened to her, that she lost her child that she had with Khal Drogo. So,
right. It's also made clear in the show that she won't have any more children.
Right. But it's just like how important that is to her. I don't know that they've driven that home. How keen of a loss that was for her. And, you know, I feel like we know more about her desire to have the throne or her desire to free the slaves liberate the masses or whatever, rather than as a woman having lost the love of her life and her child that she had with the love of her life and that sort of stuff. And so it's more poignant in the book because you're inside her head and you understand how she's feeling in that moment. And so, like I said, I think it worked in the book. It was touching in the book. And I think it just fell with a clang in the TV show. I think that it just did a bad job.
Yeah. And, you know, let's talk about that final scene, which was, looked to me like a bunch of brown people essentially worshiping a white person, right?
Right, right.
And, you know, people point out that in the context of the show, there's really no real problem with this, right? And I don't know that I entirely disagree. I mean, in the context of the show, so what are the racial, quote-unquote, politics of Game of Thrones? Like, most of the races are apparently white, and that the only, you know, the races that are not white are kind of races that we think of as the other of some sort, right? Like the Dothraki, there's this kind of foreignness to them, right? And the people from Yunkai as well.
Well, yeah, there's Westeros and then there's Essos, you know? So the West and the East. So yeah, you know, like Dany has been with the brown people for, you know, all three seasons.
So basically, they use kind of Essos as a kind of a proxy for the other, and they often make them sort of they make them obviously some kind of ethnicity that's not Caucasian to symbolize that. Would you say that's fair?
Yeah. What we will see next season, which will help muddy the waters a little bit, is House Martell, which we have not seen yet. And they're from the southernmost part of Westeros. And they're described as sort of like, I don't know, like Italian or Spanish-ish looking. So at least they're not like super white. They're from Westeros and they are, you know, not Aryan looking. I think that will make it a little less, I mean, to use black and white, you know. But yeah, I mean, all the people like Missandei and Salador San, like all those people that we've met have been very much the other. And then there are the white people. And so I'm looking forward to seeing how they cast. They haven't cast House Martell yet. And I'm looking forward to seeing how color-wise how they choose to cast that house. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. I mean, I was pretty leery of that being a spoiler, but I guess it's not even a character. I'm guessing we don't know any of those characters yet. So
right, you haven't met them. You'll meet them next season. So
or will we?
Maybe, oh gosh,
maybe we won't.
Or will you?
So I mean, I think. Why is this even worth bringing up? I guess I would just say that like we have seen the notion of the white savior kind of deployed again and again throughout pop culture. And it's very often that you see a white guy or a white woman or something, someone white, go into a foreign culture and then essentially totally save that entire culture. And one could argue that there is some pretty sort of problematic undertones with that trope. Do you know what I mean? That that, you know, that could be a damaging sort of thing to perpetuate, that, you know, white people are the savior of us all. And you know, so I can throw out some examples like The Last Samurai or Avatar, right?
Right.
Are examples of films that, like, where a white person not only...
Or The Help.
Where a white person not only went into another culture, but, like, became the savior of that culture.
Right.
And, you know, from a sort of, like, what it says about our society, you know what I mean? It kind of... there's, like, two sort of different complaints, I think, that could be made about using this trope. And one is that... it arguably sends a sort of wrong message about the place of, you know, different minorities in our society. And number two, at this point, it has become tired and warmed over and no longer interesting.
Right.
And I would use those arguments on the scene. I mean, I would say that, like, it did not feel right to watch the scene. Maybe I'm overreacting. I'm sure many listeners will write into acastofkings@gmail.com and tell me that to my face. But
no, and I mean, similarly, I often doubt myself because I was raised in California as like a bleeding heart liberal. So I often worry that I'm being oversensitive, but it made me feel really uncomfortable. That scene.
So maybe our liberalism is getting the best of us, but yeah, it is kind of, yeah, it was troubling. So I don't know if we were the only ones that were troubled. Please let us know if you guys were troubled by it at acastofkings@gmail.com. And let me just, again, I must reiterate that there is nothing inherently wrong with the scene, in the sense that there's nothing inherently wrong with Daenerys being white and she happens to rescue a race full of darker people, right? There's nothing, and as a result, they want to help her celebrate that fact. There's nothing inherently wrong with that. I think, like, but Game of Thrones does not exist in a vacuum, and when you kind of place it in the context of pop culture, which does a lot to marginalize people of color, it becomes more problematic. So, you know, if the show existed in a vacuum, totally fine. But I think the fact that it exists in a culture that has problems dealing with race in film and TV makes it, you know, considerably a harder pill to swallow. So, and a pill that left a pretty bad taste in my mouth, Jonah Robinson. I mean, like, right. I was left with a pretty negative. So I would say, like, some of the early parts of this episode were pretty great. Like, the whole small council stuff was amazing, right? And the Arya stuff was great. And so there was some great stuff in the episode. But, I mean, just ending with that scene. And, you know, I've heard a lot of book readers say there were so many cooler scenes they could have ended with. And I don't want you to necessarily reveal those, but do you feel the same way?
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. Like I've said about episode 9, there is a, like, okay, what a lot of people have brought up is that the last two seasons have ended with a big supernatural reveal, the first season being Dany's dragons, the second season being the White Walkers. You know, like a big what the fuck moment for the viewers. There is
this was a WTF moment, but not for the reasons they
not in the way that they wanted. There is a very obvious, very cool thing that they could have done. I am baffled why they didn't do it. So
it will happen next season.
Oh yeah, it'll happen. But like it would have been the best last shot. And I've also thought about, like, if I were to rearrange the episode, what would I, you know, like, I don't know why they felt like they needed to end with Dany. I think I would have ended with Arya. I think that would have been a really cool last shot. Arya's bloody hands saying Vala Morghulis, like, that would have been a really cool last shot. You know, it's not very fair for me to Wednesday evening quarterback, you know, their finale. But, like, I'm bummed because I thought episode 9 was so good. And right. I know that episode 9 is a different beast because it's this big red wedding reveal or whatever. But I just don't feel like they needed to check in the way they did with everyone. And I really just think they missed it with Dany, especially after having nailed the Astapor thing so completely. Right. They missed it with this Yunkai scene. So
I completely agree. And I mean, I think there are ways to end it that don't necessarily involve something as spectacular as the Red Wedding, but it sounds like there were a bunch more choices. So overall, I think the episode was a disappointment. And not like probably, let's see, there was, we've had a couple of other finales, right? As you mentioned.
Right.
And I would say, yeah, this is probably the most underwhelming finale out of the three. Do we agree on this?
Yes.
Okay. So hopefully better things ahead for season four of Game of Thrones. So I think we have time for a couple of emails, but before we get to the emails, Joanna, I guess, it may, and let's just say like, we'll do a couple of emails and we'll do a separate show with more emails later on, because for you guys to respond to our thoughts from this episode.
Right.
But overall, what'd you think of the season? You know what I mean? Like, I guess we should just talk about overall impressions.
I thought it was a great season, obviously. I mean, I love the show. I think it's one of the best things going. I think the Red Wedding and the subsequent reaction around the world, not to overstate it, but around the world of like people's feelings about this story that they are so wrapped up in, there's nothing else like it going. And I think that's so cool. So not just like as a piece of art itself, but as a pop cultural phenomenon, I think Game of Thrones is so interesting and wonderful. There are things that I would change, of course, as we've mentioned over and over and over again. But I think in general, they're just doing a bang up job. They introduced a ton of new characters, and they're going to have to do the same thing next season. So, you know, I think they do a really good job. I don't know if I brought this up, but if you think about, you know, when Dany, like two episodes ago, when Dany was in her tent plotting her invasion, she was surrounded by characters that we all know now. Only one of them we knew last season, you know? So they've done a really good job of tackling what George R. R. Martin does, which is just seed in new characters and seed in new characters. That's a huge challenge for a TV show. And can you think of another TV show? I mean, other than The Wire, which did a similar thing because it told different stories every season, but like where you have such an influx of new characters every season and you come to care about them as much as you do. So I would overall, I really did love this season. I still maintain that the finale missed the mark, but you know, it doesn't sully the entire season for me.
Yes. The season remains unsullied. I mean, this season is just way better than last season, I thought, right? The huge improvement. I mean, but mostly because there were two absolutely shocking moments that, like, you know, you will just remember forever, right? That one being the sacking of Astapor and the other being the Red Wedding, right? Right. This season gave you two of those holy crap moments. Like, I got to talk about this with my friends around the water cooler moments, right? Like that. Very few other shows can rise to that level. Acting, a lot of the special effects, and a lot of the plotting were just top notch. Say the high points for me, right? That those moments that I already mentioned, and also the Jaime Brienne storyline was just fantastic. Like the Jaime Brienne storyline was like this season was kind of like the Theon storyline last season, right?
For what you connected to,
right? In terms of like how much I was invested in it, and I was invested in it. So it's just so well executed those storylines, and really got to me. In terms of low points, the finale. Really, really weak. Samwell being useless for most of the season, I thought was pretty bad. And like the entire Jon Snow storyline didn't really resonate for me until this episode. Actually, I thought it was kind of it was a little bit powerful the way that Ygritte has to experience that betrayal.
So it's Ygritte's plotline that's more compelling, though, than John's plotline, right?
Yeah, because John doesn't really change, right? John is just a really unconvincing wildling throughout the entire thing, whereas Ygritte has to deal with falling in love and then, you know, being a traitor to her own people and then being betrayed and so on and so forth.
Right.
So I think those were I got to say the Theon storyline is also, like, huge disappointment because the show made you endure all that and for not much payoff, in my opinion. So,
And what I'll say, I mean, the reason a lot of people have asked me whether or not they should read the books, and when they should start, like, you know, should I just start midway through, you know, book three or whatever, if I haven't read it so far and I want to, you know, start reading from here. And what I keep saying is no, start at book one. Books one through three of the Song of Ice and Fire are three of just the best sci-fi fantasy has to offer. And for all the high points that you mentioned in this season of Game of Thrones, that's only half of book three.
I heard it's more like 2/3.
Well, it is 2/3, but like they pack, you know, it packs a wallop at the end. So like book three is so good.
It's worth reading the first two books just to get to book three.
Seriously. Yeah. Or you could just read book three, I guess. But like, why would you when you can go back and read the other two?
I might just read book three.
Okay. But what I'm saying is that like all the things you enjoyed in this season, you know, we still have some great stuff to come next season. And that's all contained in one book. And George R. R. Martin just did a fantastic job with A Storm of Swords. So, you know, and they're doing a fantastic job adapting it. So we're all very lucky to have it, I think.
Yeah. Agreed. All right. Joanna, I don't have much time now, but let's talk about one or two emails. Actually, I do want to mention so first of all, Lauren from Ohio wrote this email in about this episode, actually. That final scene, yikes. I know many dislike the Danny storyline, but I am not one of them. Even I have to admit that was a terrible way to finish the season. Although poorly executed, I have to say it did drive a powerful message home. While the Lannisters, Freys, and Tyrells and the like play their Game of Thrones, no one is inspiring true loyalty in their bannermen like Daenerys's. As the realm becomes more concerned with the White Walkers, what would a direct hit from, say, Dragon... I don't know what she's saying here, but I'll just stop the email right there and just say that, you know, I think that's a good point, that, like, Dany is one of the few characters that inspires true loyalty in her men. So
The other point we want to make, without spoiling anything...
Okay.
Tread is softball. That... No, honestly, is that this is not the series finale. This is a season finale, right?
Yeah.
If the series finale were, it would be a lot more disturbing for a series finale to end with Danny being held aloft by a sea of, you know, swarthier individuals. This is a point on Danny's journey. You know what I mean? So that's just.
So let's leave it at that.
That's all I'm saying.
Yep.
You know what I mean? It's not the series finale. It's a season finale. So.
All right. So, let's just make a couple of mentions of Red Wedding and then wrap this up. So we got a lot of emails in response to last week's episode with regards to the Red Wedding. We can't get to all of them this week. We'll hopefully get to some more next week. With regards to – so I want to make something really clear. First of all, I've calmed down a lot from last week, okay? And I now have accepted the idea that I saw what I saw and it's okay. I think a lot of people mistook my reaction for the reaction that a lot of people had, which was, OMG, I hate George R. R. Martin. This show sucks. I hate the show. How dare you kill these people? That's actually not my complaint at all. I'm totally fine with those people dying. I think I just had a very visceral reaction to this pregnant woman being shown explicitly, you know, cut open. That was really like... I've seen a lot of stuff in movies, but for some reason that image really disturbed me. So I'm totally fine with these characters getting killed off like all of a sudden, and I respect that as a storytelling device, but just that image really got to me. So just want to make that clear. Let's read this email from someone named Grey Wind's Ghost. Please stop crying in your beer for those awful Starks. You only love them because of their pretty hair and their pretty eyes. Those treacherous, oath-breaking, no-good-for-nothing Starks got exactly what was coming to them. Catelyn started the War of the Five Kings by kidnapping Tyrion, who was innocent. Ned admitted to being a traitor in front of everyone, in front of the Sept of Baelor, and rightly had his head removed for plotting the murder of the king based upon a hunch about hair color. And where do we start with Robb? Robb, who swore to marry one of Walder Frey's daughters in exchange for a tactical advantage? Robb, who instead married another, turning his back on his betrothed? Robb, who is willing to marry off his uncle, again for a tactical advantage? He's just awful. So good riddance. And Kat, who started this whole mess, she made matters far worse by releasing the most valuable POW in all of Westeros, the Kingslayer. As a result of that fine bit of treason, Robb ended up chopping off the head of his father's bannerman, Richard Karstark, and watching half his army ride home. I mean, the Starks were only at the Twins because of the consequences of Kat's royal screw-up. Plus, Catelyn slit the throat of Walder's unarmed wife in cold blood. So,
I don't know if that was like satire or what that was.
Really? I thought that was a legit, some legit complaints about the Starks there. I mean, did you not agree with any of that?
Maybe some.
I mean, I do think there's an argument to be made that the Starks are kind of terrible, right? But at the same time,
no, that whole nonsense with Ned, though, that's what makes me.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, Ned was obviously just trying to do the best thing.
Right. I've already said negative things about Kat, and then people are like, shut up about Kat. So,
well, Tasha Robinson at AV Club wrote this piece called Why Game of Thrones Red Wedding Packs Such an Emotional Impact. And here is Tasha's explanation, right? Robb and Catelyn had a combination of righteousness, purity, and resources that no one else on the show could claim. They were traditional, ideologically pure good guys. They weren't after power for selfish, grasping reasons. They had a moral calling to avenge Eddard's murder at the hands of the treacherous Lannister family and reclaim Catelyn's daughters from the Lannister's abusive household. They were stepping up to face an unwanted but necessary challenge to protect their family and country in a mature, considered, responsible way. They were playing the part of conventional fantasy heroes, wronged and seeking justice. And in any conventional hero's journey story, Robb would be expected to save the day and triumph. Having him go down as the victim of a sneaky, cowardly plot is like watching Harry Potter get fatally gut shot at the Yule Ball halfway through the books. He's the hero. He's supposed to win, no matter what it takes. Jenna Robinson, what were your thoughts on this interpretation?
I mean, it's valid, but on the other hand, I think other people have made a good point, which we brought up earlier this episode, that Robb is, he's kind of Harry Potter and he's kind of not, or he's kind of Frodo and he's kind of not, in that he is the ostensible hero. He's the Prince Valiant, but they didn't really develop him well enough. He's not, as I've mentioned before, he's not a point of view character in the book, so you don't get his internal life very much. And so you don't, like, he's not Harry Potter because you aren't journeying with him the way that you were journeying with Ned in the first season. You don't feel, as much as the show has tried to do it, I think, by humanizing him with the whole Talisa plot, you're not with Ned, with Robb, the same way you were with Ned, or the same way Harry Potter fans are with Harry Potter.
Yeah.
And so I think there's a difference there. But I agree that in terms of the reversal of traditional storytelling, that's true. They've killed the Prince Valiant. But, you know, I think it would be, if it had happened this season that Arya had died, that would have been way more of a gunshot for us because we are with her so much more
right.
than we are with him.
Yeah,
you know?
No, I agree completely. Let me just say before I say anything else that Tasha Robinson is like one of my favorite writers / online personalities of all time. And so nothing I say should be meant to take away from that. But I will say that I did find Tasha's argument problematic for a number of reasons. One of them being that, yeah, like Arya still represents kind of the similar dynamic. I think the reason why people were so like my theory, I guess, is that Robb and Catelyn vaguely represented forces of good, and their death was so underhanded and so graphic that the combination of those factors is what resulted in the reaction. Not that Robb and Catelyn were the sort of final vanguards of good in Westeros. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
Because we have other forces of good, specifically Arya, but I mean, maybe not after her dark turn this episode. So I just found it a little, I thought she was stretching a little bit. Like, at the same time, though, any attempt to make sense of like the reaction to last week's episode, I think is valuable. So
it's valuable, but it's also enough to say, it's a visceral, like, you don't necessarily have to have an intellectual reaction.
Right. You can just say
it's a visceral.
These were the quasi good guys of the show, and they were murdered brutally and unfairly. Right.
Right.
And that's enough, I think. Let me just read one last email here from Doug, who writes in that he really enjoyed last week's podcast And he said, one thing I was curious to hear you guys weigh in on is the enormous implications this has on the landscape of Westeros. There is literally nobody left to oppose the Lannisters in the short term. The Tyrells seem like the only other major force, and they are on the Lannister side. Now the Boltons and Freys are on their side as well, if they weren't already. On top of that, with Robb dead and Bran and Rickon presumed dead, Winterfell and the North belongs to Sansa and Tyrion, ergo the Lannisters. I know you can't say anything about it, but I just don't see how anything can disrupt the stronghold the Lannisters have on Westeros until or unless Dany crosses the Narrow Sea. I know you can't really talk about this, Jonna, so let me just say I do think that's one of the reasons that that episode was so effective, is because it changes the game, not only in terms of the Westeros dynamics, but also in terms of the show. Like, we've been hopscotching around each of these plot lines for quite some time, and so the way the show is going to be structured is going to be different now. I mean, there's one less plot line, obviously. But there was this kind of momentum and these kind of convergence of these plot lines, right, of Kat and Rob and Talisa. And that's all gone away now. So I do think it is a major game changer. And I think, right, the biggest threat to the Lannisters now is Daenerys. How long that plot line will take to play out, I mean, it could be years before we find out. So I do look forward to seeing how it wraps up, though. So,
God, I'm so annoyed. I can't say anything. I'm so annoyed.
Is my analysis somewhat astute, at least?
I'm not going to say anything.
Okay.
That's a spoiler trap that I'm not walking into, but I'm really excited to comment upon it next season.
Okay. Well, I think that's going to do it for us today, Jonna Robinson. So shall we wrap it up? You want to let people know where they can find more of your work on the internet this week?
Yes, they can find me every day on Pajiba.com, or they can follow me on Twitter at QuitYourJRob.
Find me at Twitter.com/DaveChensky. That's Dave Chen, S-K-Y, and DaveChen.net. Join us on Facebook at Facebook.com/A Cast of Kings. That's Facebook.com/A Cast of Kings. And tune in next week. We're going to have a bonus episode with more feedback, as well as an episode featuring the Kickstarter backer who won the chance to record with us for a bonus episode. So that'll be a lot of fun.
Poor woman.
I know.
Punishment. I know. And I did have a book recommendation this week, if that's...
Let us know.
If that's time.
Do it.
This is a posthumous nod to Ian M. Banks, who passed away this last week. And he is a great sci-fi writer. He's written the Culture series, is a great series of novels, and it's more sci-fi than it is fantasy, and Game of Thrones is more fantasy, so I've been trying to veer more in the fantasy realm, but I just did want to give this nod to this really great author who, it's a huge loss in the community, and he passed away. The Culture series, which is a stellar, it's a seminal piece of work, and I really suggest you guys check that out. So,
all right, can you repeat the name again?
The author is Ian M. Banks. That's I-A-I-N because he's Scottish. So he likes to put an extra vowel in there. And the series that I would recommend is the Culture series.
All right. Well, thank you guys for listening to this week's episode of A Cast of Kings. We'll see you guys soon.